we trust. Charge we're not sure about.
Welcome to the In Tech We Trust podcast, episode 46, and actually, happy Windows 10 Day, everybody. Did anybody on the podcast get their copy of Windows 10 yet?
Not yet. Apparently, my build of Windows 8.1, while properly licensed, isn't slated to get it. I'm going to...
I'm gonna upgrade...
the outstanding updates and then try again and see if maybe there's like basically it needs to clear up what it has to do because there's 13 or so that haven't been done, but all the cool kids are, just not me.
How quickly will you get onto it once you've got it?
I think that myself and my role, I need to be on the cutting edge in this space. I'm really going to be pushing it. Well, I mean, I co-authored the book on Windows 8 with Microsoft Press, so I'm drinking
I'm sorry,
that
you what? Really?
I did. Yes, I did.
I did not know that.
Yes, it was. I did the Hyper-V chapter, and I've been very committed to the new Windows OSs.
Excellent. So I'm pretty excited as well, actually. So I'm quite a fan of Windows 8, actually. I've got 8.1 on the desktop at home and on the laptop. I'm just a little nervous, though, for whether or not all of my applications that I use for day-to-day work will work straight away with Windows 10. So I haven't quite got a strategy yet. I do have a spare desktop in the office that I don't use at the moment. It's pretty decent spec, so I might see if I can frig it onto there first. But I'm the kind of person that I don't know that I'll get any like real value out of it, but I've got to have that latest tech, if you know what I mean. I'm like a kid and it's a new toy and I'm like, I just got to have it. Why do you need it, Nigel? Oh, you know what, I haven't really got a good reason, I just want it.
Two funny stories. I have two applications that are very old, and I'm going to pull up the timestamp on one of them. And they actually both are about the same age.
Are they like 16-bit or something?
I don't know. I don't know what bit level they are, but this one is called LView Pro. Oh, 32-bit, timestamp 1996.
Oh.
To this day, Nigel, this is the best lightweight video editor. I got this in like 1995 or 1996, and I got it when I was in college. And basically, it does this thing called batch conversion of JPEGs. Think of your camera. They are not made to be efficient, like a digital camera, even one on your phone. This batch conversion will take a whole folder of JPEGs, and they are, say, 4 and 6 megabytes each. It will save them down to 500K with no loss, no loss of quality. And the other thing I use, believe it or not, I don't know if you use it there in the UK, is Quicken for, you know, like personal financial management.
Oh, no, never heard of it.
It's basically like an automated check register where you can pay your bills, you can watch your spend, you can, you know, watch the balance on your cash accounts, credit accounts, and the like. My needs are simple there. I am using Quicken like 5.0 from 1997. I got the patch that came out in 1998, so I'm good. But those two apps, I'm good. Those are the two apps I hold on to, which I think they'll be fine. I still use them to this day on Windows 8.1.
And you know what? If Windows 10 rocks and rolls with those old ancient apps there, I think, you know, some kudos to Microsoft there. Because, I don't know, I always think it's some kind of fine balance between backwards compatibility and pushing the boundary with, you know, new and funky apps that do all kind of cool stuff. If it does the cool stuff and it still runs those apps, wow, round of applause to Microsoft. You'll have to report back on that.
I will. Hopefully, I'll have a better update next week. Maybe I'll get on it. I mean, I hadn't participated in the beta. I obviously haven't been updating my own PCs. So it's time to check that up, and I'll let you know how it goes next week.
Hey, this is Ken. So I have to confess, I'm actually a pure Mac and Linux guy.
Okay.
So I do have a, I have a VM running on my Mac that's running Windows XP.
What? What's that for?
So I can run this one personal finance program that only works with XP and lower. So I spin that up maybe once a week, and basically that's the only time I ever see a Windows desktop.
Man, you need to get a new app, because having to like maintain a Windows XP VM just for that.
Well, like I said, I bring it up 1 hour a week maybe. So yeah. and then I just shut the whole thing down, and I'm just on my Mac and my Linux.
And honestly, Nigel, I would be in the same boat as Ken if I would really have to change my app with my personal finance app. The image one, I actually probably have a lot more options on the Mac space. But, if I switched OSs, I'd probably have to have a VM for that Quicken app. Or maybe, my wife might use a PC, but the moment I want to get into it, I'd have to use a VM in the same fashion. I've got like a network and stuff. So I would be guilty of that too, Nigel, should I be an alternative OS guy, but I'm not.
Fair enough. Okay, so there's no Mark this week. I think Mark's off fishing. Gabriel, have they piped down on the announcement in the background where you are?
Yeah, to a certain extent, because I went into a giant hall, which is about 90% less loud, but still somewhat loud. And, obviously, it would not be a podcast without me having a discussion from someplace where there's a massive amount of background noise.
Just go in the kitchen. Everything will be fine.
That's what we used to, right?
That was from the kitchen. Well, that was a table next to the kitchen at Papa Doe at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. I actually remember that one pretty good.
You're committed, I'll give you that. And we've got a special guest on the show this week as well, we've already heard. So, Ken Hoy. Ken, how are you doing?
Fine. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Hey, thanks for being on the podcast, Ken. Really appreciate it. So, you know what? Before we dive into news from the week and business news and stuff like that, Ken, tell us a little bit about what you do and what you're interested in, where you're working at the moment.
Sure. So I've actually been in the IT space for, probably about two decades now. Been at the user side, but also at a couple of vendors. Most recently, I was actually at Rackspace at EMC and EMC doing OpenStack as my focus. And that kind of leads me to where I am today, which is I am actually at a startup that is in the OpenStack space called Platform 9. And I joined about 2 months ago, a little less than that, as the director of technical marketing. There's only one of me, so I'm just directing myself.
Hey, who do you report to?
So I report to Suresh Raghuram, who is the CEO and one of the co-founders of the company. We're hoping to grow.
How many employees do you have?
Let me see. So the way I find out how many people are in the company is I look at Slack.
Oh, yeah?
And see how many people are on Slack.
Wow.
And that's the future, right?
I see 30 people on the general Slack channel. So minus three interns, I guess we have 27 full-time employees.
You're pretty early there then as like an evangelist, I guess. If there's less than 100 people, obviously, and they've already hired somebody into your position, I think that's pretty cool, that.
Yeah, I'm very happy that it all worked out. I'm actually employee number 23, I think.
Nice.
So this was a great opportunity to get in on the ground floor of a company that I think has a pretty unique value prop around cloud management and OpenStack and VMware. So, I had kind of the experience and the skill set they were looking for at this point. So, and I like the folks a lot at the company. So it's kind of all came together pretty quickly.
I tell you what it says to me, right? So OpenStack, I'm like a fan of it in the sense of, the techie inside of me is interested and intrigued by OpenStack and really wants it to succeed. I'm not sure it's got necessarily that much traction in the market right now. But the fact that somebody like yourself is willing to jump in there at a startup that's so small, I mean, obviously you've got to be committed to the startup and think that they can make it. But effectively, the way I see it, right, Platform 9 have pinned themselves against OpenStack as well. So you're pretty much dependent on the success. For Platform 9 to be a success, OpenStack needs to be a success, right? So you as an individual have got to believe both in OpenStack and the future of OpenStack, as well as Platform 9 and what they're trying to accomplish, right? Yeah. Am I on the ball there?
Pretty much. I will say this. I'm a big believer in OpenStack. I've been involved in it, obviously, back from the day when I was the OpenStack evangelist at Rackspace. But one of the things I actually liked about Platform 9 is that the value prop and the way we do things, it actually, in some ways, doesn't matter that it's OpenStack or not. as the technology we're using. In fact, the company was founded not as a way to deliver OpenStack to customers was really, how do we do cloud management? And then we looked around and said, OpenStack seemed the best way to do that. But in reality, we can pivot pretty quickly, I think, based on how we are using the technology.
Okay, but quick question, right? What would you pivot to? Is there an alternative in like the on-prem enterprise class private stroke hybrid cloud space?
So interestingly enough, when company was first formed, because so many of the founders actually came from VMware, they actually looked at vCloud.
Okay, yeah.
but decided that wasn't actually the best solution for what we want, what they were looking to do. So my point is that, if at the end of the day, if OpenStack doesn't work out, and again, I actually think it has a bright future, and I think we've made the right choice by selecting OpenStack as our underlying technology. The reality is another cloud platform came in, or if everyone decided we're not using, forget cloud platforms, we're just going to use container orchestration. In theory, we can actually move to that and still deliver a lot of the same value prop around infrastructure management.
Well, one question, Ken, because I definitely appreciate the new techie, kind of like what Nigel was saying, the new technology and the techie in us. But, what's the biggest challenge that you see to evangelize these types of things?
I think the biggest challenge is that things are moving so quickly. I think people are confused. I think people don't really know what technologies they should place their bets on. I think a lot of people have started looking at OpenStack, and that's growing. But I've also started talking to people who are saying, maybe we just skip the OpenStack thing completely and move to containers. But then once they get there, they go, well, do we go Docker? Do we go Mesos? Do we go Kubernetes?
Or do you wait for 2.0, wait for the next iteration? Maybe this is all too early. I mean, there's still a lot of CIOs that like that wait and see approach, but because it moves too fast, maybe nothing ever gets done. That's kind of where I was going with my question.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the way we are trying to get around that a bit is we don't actually come to a lot of the enterprises and go, here's this new technology. Now you need to change everything you do and bring up brand new environments. We've actually, one of the value props we have at Platform 9 is we actually work pretty hard to make sure that we work with brownfield environments. So for example, our cloud management actually works with existing VMware environments. So you can take something that's been running for 2 years in your vSphere cluster and basically layer OpenStack APIs on top.
I'm just knocked down by the term brownfield. I've never heard that term. I've heard greenfield, but now I got a brownfield. Cheers to that.
That's right. and it's amazing how much that breaks down barriers, right? Because when you tell people, technology is happening so quickly, but you can actually dip your toes in and kind of get into it gradually and not have to basically write off everything you've done for the past 5 years. That actually makes them feel safe about entering the new technology space.
Ken, a quick question just around Platform 9 then. For me, and maybe for some listeners who don't know them,
sure.
What is it exactly that you're trying to do? Is it managed OpenStack for, let's say I'm an enterprise that wants to deploy a cloud platform, right? But I don't think I've got the staff. Do I talk to you guys to design it and manage it for me going forward? What is the deal there?
I kind of distinguish a bit from some of the other players that do managed services around OpenStack. For example, I know you had Tyler from Blue Box on. So they do, they basically manage the entire environment soup to nuts, right? Including the hardware. What we do is very specifically the cloud management layer. So think of us kind of an additive. So if you're a customer who has an existing KVM or VMware or future Docker environment, and you say, I want to take that and I want to make it more agile. I want to be able to, give developers self-service access and be able to orchestrate applications on top. You can bring us in. We basically kind of layer our APIs on top of your existing infrastructure. And we manage that cloud management layer as a SaaS platform. So we actually host the cloud controllers, the cloud control plane offsite. But we talk to a customer's on-site environment. And again, the cool thing is we'll actually discover what they already have existing. So if we do our job right, I always tell customers, we're almost invisible to a customer, right? We're just managing this cloud platform layer that delivers self-service APIs to end users, to the developers, but the admins actually continue using the same tools and processes that they want to manage their VMware or KVM environment.
Cool. You know, what kind of customer types are you having the most success with? So are there particular verticals that you're having more success in? Are there particular sizes of companies or, you know, companies that are in particular points of transition? Or what's your sweet spot?
I think we're actually covering all different verticals. I think, obviously, companies that aren't a Walmart or an eBay that can't hire, you know, don't have the money to hire, you know, 20, 30 engineers just to run their cloud platform.
Thousands.
Well, I think that includes their developers, right, for the apps. But people who can't really afford to do that, or people who just want to get, you know, they want to be able to get this up and running very quickly, we're basically a good fit for. So we've got customers who, in less than an hour, they're layering our solution on top of their existing environment. Their developers are running around, you know, provisioning their own VMs.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question, actually. So once I engage with you and you come out and I guess you come out and we have a chat and we talk about what I'm trying to achieve, how long before I actually start seeing something, you know, in real world terms, from initial engagement to having OpenStack up and running and providing self-service and orchestration and stuff like that?
Yeah, so the process is really simple. Basically, you sign up for an account on our website, and then when a system picks that up and approves it, we actually automate the process of spinning up an OpenStack control plane that's unique for a particular customer. And then you basically get an email that says, hey, you know, here's a URL, click on that, and it takes you to a dedicated web page where you can download an agent onto your environment. And all you basically do at that point is if the agent, let's say it's a VMware environment, the agent actually will talk to your vCenter servers once you enter the credentials and basically import that up to cloud control plane. If you got KVM, it discovers your KVM environment and does the same thing. So literally the time it takes for you to download the agent and run it, and then the time it takes for us to do the dynamic discovery is basically the time it takes for you to have an OpenStack environment up and running.
I'm sure I'm old-fashioned, right? That sounds so scary to me. Like, what you mean? You don't have guys that come out and talk to me and take me out to dinner first and stuff like that? It's like, oh.
I'm happy to come out and talk to you for dinner.
It's a more personal relationship now.
Hey, so let's pivot slightly because we do need to cover the tech news and biz news and stuff like that as well. But last week, we talked a little bit about Kubernetes going 1.0. And I'm not sure that I fully understand what's happening here, but it's no longer, well, not that it was ever like totally a Google project, I suppose. You know, they open sourced it, made it available to the community. But it's now under the auspices of the Cloud Native Computing Platform, part of the Linux Foundation. Is that right? Is that something that you know about, Ken?
Yeah, so I was actually fortunate enough to be at OSCON last week. So I was actually at the launch.
Nice.
So yeah, so Kubernetes is 1.0. It's now part of I think it's called the Cloud Native Computing Foundation.
Oh, what did I call it?
I forgot. I think you added a word.
I'm sure I did.
Now, the interesting thing about a couple of the interesting things about that foundation is if you look at it, it's almost like an exact match for the, the Open Container Initiative?
Yeah.
So it's basically the same people. So what I heard at the, you know, during the launch is that although that obviously Kubernetes is kind of front and center CNF, it's the Cloud Native Computing Foundation. Actually, what they really want to focus on is what they call reference implementations.
Okay.
What are actually the design principles for building cloud native apps, and how do you put together all the technologies to actually build a cloud native app environment? And you saw that too during the launch. I think they spent maybe half the time talking about Kubernetes, But the other half of the time, they were actually trying to explain what cloud native actually means.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing then? You know, I always think if you have to explain something to people and it's not just intuitive, then...
No, that's not bad. That's normal. With the advancements, it's the not Moore's law, but, you know, the In Tech We Trust law, where it gets more complicated over time, you know, and we need smarter people on the other end to receive this information, to understand the goal, and then to give it a try. So in today's world, Nigel, I'm for complicated. We just got to play with it to get there.
Well, it definitely challenges your marketing teams in order to craft the kind of message going forward that's going to resonate not only with the C-suite decision maker people, but from the ground up, you know, the bottom implementation tech field, right? And, you know, every company that's a startup that's trying to change the dynamics or everything that's, you know, kind of a new and influential space, you know, that they struggle with messaging, they struggle with definitions. It's just part of the nature of the beast. That we're in right now with things changing so much faster than they have in the past.
I think Google's actually learned by looking at, to be frank, some of the stuff that you're seeing in the OpenStack space, right? Which is, I don't know if there was a lot of good education in the beginning about what OpenStack was a good fit for. You had companies, I think, who, you know, in the past, maybe even now, who's kind of said, you know, the OpenStack is basically a open free version of VMware. So I'm just going to take my VMware environment and just plop it unchanged onto OpenStack. And then things don't work as they had hoped. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why you've seen some issues with OpenStack adoption, because of that lack of understanding of what cloud native means in a OpenStack or cloud context. I think Google and that ecosystem is trying to avoid that by saying, Let's try to get ahead of this and try to explain to enterprises what cloud native is so that we can try to avoid some of the same mistakes.
Hey, Ken, a slightly different question. On the future of Kubernetes, okay, what is your opinion on its future? Because the way I'm looking at things, it looks almost as if it's potentially poised to become almost the de facto implementation of a container management and orchestration platform. I know there are others out there, right? But the only one that really seems to stick out to me, right, would be Amazon's, ECS, their container platform service, because they're the only ones that I can see long-term viable could, you know, withstand something like Kubernetes, because, you know, Microsoft are playing with them, Google obviously play with them, OpenStack play with them. So Kubernetes is almost seems to be gaining this momentum to become, you know, the de facto cloud container orchestration platform. Maybe I said cloud orchestration earlier. I meant container orchestration.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
With Amazon being the one, you know, potential giant out there that's got an alternative. Do you see it playing out like that or totally differently or similarly?
Certainly, I think that's what Google would like, right? I think, frankly, right now, Mesos probably has more actual production deployments based on the fact that it's just been out there longer.
Uh-huh.
And it's been used by, you know, it's Mesos, for example, is what Twitter actually uses to run their production. So I think that, and obviously Docker would like to get in on this.
Yeah.
So I think this is actually partly what the CNCF.
It's terrible about. Acronym. Yeah.
I know. So if you think about what actually, you know, especially now in the open source space, what determines the winners, right? I think I would argue ecosystem defines the winner, right? The one of the biggest and most developed ecosystem wins. And if you're Google, who are you up against that have a better ecosystem than you do in this space? It's AWS and it's Docker.
Yeah.
And in some sense, Mesos, right? Because of all the deployments. So I think those are the people they're watching out for. And I think they're the people that the foundation is trying to neuter in some sense or try to come up against. Because I think Docker is looking out there and Docker wants to own they want to own container management, right? Because that's the only way that's the only way they're going to make money.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Right. They're not making money off the runtime, clearly. I don't think they're going to be a $3 billion company by selling subscription to their hub right? No. The only choice, the only option they have is they have to own all of the container management space at some point. And Google recognizes that. And this is, I think, their play to try to build an ecosystem around that Kubernetes to before Docker completely captures that ecosystem.
Fair play. Okay. Anybody for anything else on that?
No, I mean, Ken and I talked about this the other week at IndieVMUG, and it's definitely he's got his finger right on the pulse of the direction of where that stuff needs to go. I mean, obviously, you're not going to make billions of dollars in value selling stickers and T-shirts, but you can try.
Hey, I like stickers and T-shirts, but my pockets aren't deep enough to make them a billion-dollar company now.
I do have a Docker sticker on my laptop.
Oh, there you go. Well, it's more than I've got, actually, so yeah.
What? Is that possible? That they haven't sent you, you did a code course and they haven't sent you a sticker yet.
It's shameful. I know. No sweat. So let's pivot to tech news. This week, got actually, I don't know, what's that, three or four items. First up, Datrium, I don't know how to pronounce it. Storage startup, though, coming out of stealth, and according to their own tweet, right, I like this, proclaiming themselves as a new dominant player in the data storage world. I mean, I suppose you're hardly going to proclaim yourself as just one of the rest, right, but good grief. For a company just out of stealth to say they're dominant, okay. They look interesting, though. There's been a ton of talk about Intel and Micron announcing 3D cross-point memory, potentially a serious contender for the future of memory storage, maybe. Oh, at the other end of the spectrum, though, Google, again, they've announced their cloud-based Nearline storage service with some kind of offer for 100 terabytes of free storage, as long as you fit the criteria of the small print. I don't expect to see too many companies rushing to take them up on that when I look at the small print, though. And finally, well, I don't know really anything about this, but I mentioned it at the beginning of the show. It's Windows 10 day, yeah? Woot, woot. So on those topics of news, anybody got anything that particularly stands out to them that they want to talk about?
I don't get the Datrium announcement.
Okay, how come?
I mean, love their first tweet.
Oh,
well, yeah. But I mean, I'm reading some of the news we had, and believe it or not, listeners, we do prepare a little bit here. But...
Hey, what you're saying, Rick?
come on. But I'm first of all, a 2U appliance as a server-side flash management. So, you know, I'll admit there are so many accelerators and new ways of doing things. But the fact that I'm pulling it out of the hypervisor into an appliance, that's a different approach. And that doesn't sit well with me. I like the idea of flash in the server or using memory or flash on the array, but a dedicated accelerator, or is it? Is it an accelerator or
a I interpreted it a different way. I thought it was a caching software solution that works in conjunction with an external array.
Yeah,
which brought me to think, I'm like, did nobody ever pay attention to Project Thunder Lightning? Because that got tried by EMC and didn't really go anywhere. Granted, you know, I think they might have ran into some implementation issues on that one. I mean, to me, it sounds like somebody took the concept of Pernix data and built an array that you would connect to as well.
Exactly. So it's yet another architecture for the same thing. And I'm all 100% wait and see on that one, baby.
Yeah, me too. The way I read it, I don't know if it's similar or different to what you guys have said there, but I think, aren't they like, you can buy your own servers, I thought, and have like flash in there, and then you can spin up ASXi, and in the future probably something else. But then it's got, yeah, this like external shelf of storage somewhere else. But the interesting thing for me, I think maybe again like what you were saying, Gabriel, about Thunder and Lightning at EMC, is all of the data services run on the actual node itself where the flash is, but I don't think it caches any writes there. So like any writes...
Right. And that's the hard thing to do, right? I mean, anybody... that's not the challenge. It's doing the right.
Yeah, so I think the jury's out on that one at the moment. Does anybody have anything to say about the Intel and Micron announcement about this 3D cross-point memory? Like, I tried to read an article on it. Was it yesterday? I think Nick Howells posted something about it and included the IntequiTrust Twitter handle on it. So I went and took a look, and it was like, it was proper feeds and speeds and like uber technical engineering.
A nerd knob.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
A nerdgasm, that's right. And that's what you need from Intel and Micron, right? These are the players in the industry that are that underlying DNA of what we do above with software and Flash and all that. So I'm not familiar with it, but if they're saying that's awesome, I would check it out.
There were some good articles out there. I mean, IEEE had a piece out there that went into a little bit of it. You know, it's one of these things like, you know, I'll harken back to when they announced phase change memory and memristor and all these other technologies, like the next biggest, awesomest thing ever. I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, but isn't the thing there, Gabriel, that they're talking about products early 2016, so they're actually manufacturing wafers of this stuff now, and they expect it to be shipping in products. Now, I don't know what they mean by products, probably not enterprise-class storage array type stuff yet, okay? Handheld devices, consumer goods and things, no doubt. But if it really is at the point where it's products next year, and all the buzz that was on the wire about it. I mean, you know, most of the...
Slow news day.
I suppose it could be, yeah. I mean...
I see where you're going with it. I mean, I think part of the challenge is that anytime you're going to introduce something that is significantly disruptive, it's going to get a lot of buzz and a lot of attention. And I think people see the potential in what they're trying to do, and they see 1,000 times faster than Flash and yada, yada, yada. It'll remain to be seen what... factor or form factor or what, how it actually comes into play or into being and how it's productized and what the cost, you know, spectrum looks like and everything else under the sun. Right now it's all just guesswork.
Well, here's one sentence. This technology is up to 1,000 times faster and has up to 1,000 times greater endurance than NAND and is 10 times denser than conventional memory. That is a bold statement.
It is, but all of these up to 1,000 times faster. That means it could be 2 times faster, or it could be, you know, in extreme cases.
Okay, sure, but the middle of that is still amazing as a multiplier. Even a half-baked effort of that is still amazing.
Yeah, yeah. If it's 10 times faster, that would be a... fairly revolutionary.
Well,
uptake.
I get where you're coming from there, right? And I don't knock it, but at the end of the day, so it's much faster than Flash or NAND Flash, right? It's slower than DRAM, though, still. And it costs, or they're projecting it's going to cost somewhere in between the two. Whoop-de-doo. I mean, yeah, if it was like non-volatile and... on the price scale of NAND flash per terabyte, but it was faster than DRAM as well, or as fast as DRAM, then I'd probably get excited. Don't get me wrong, I'm not excited about it. I am actually quite interested in this. But I don't know, when I just did that quick comparison, I was like, all right, okay, so yeah, 1,000 times faster sounds great. You know, NAND flash is, whatever, 1,000 times faster than disk, okay? But you tend to pay more for it. So, again, with this, we'll pay more than we do for NAND flash, but it's not quite as fast and it's not quite as durable as DRAM, and we'll probably pay a bit less than DRAM. Okay. I mean, maybe we're getting a new tier of storage here, and maybe architectures going forward will work with that as a different tier. You know, it'll sit in between DRAM and NAND flash, but...
Okay, I remember in 2010 when RRAM was the next hot thing. And they were saying, in 2015, you'll have it, and you'll be able to buy it and get it out there, yada, yada, yada. Well, still waiting.
Yeah. Assuming this works out, I think the interesting thing is, will this drive down the price on NAND and basically, you know, kind of accelerate the day where we start, we're going to be all flash, literally all flash.
I can't wait. Right. When flash, even the crappy stuff becomes commodity. That's an interesting point, Ken, because I've seen people that go around and say, hey, my data center is all 100% flash. They're referring to the consumer grade SSDs. But when you have something like this and then lowered prices on other tiers come into the market, this is really going to be a big deal. So I see where you're going with that. Maybe this is another technology. It makes the new tier one, the new tier two, that these other tiers, which are still good, become much more price attractive. So maybe that's a good thing.
I don't know. I'm still struggling to find customers who need 100,000 IAP workloads.
Okay, that's a good point.
Let alone 10 million IOP workload, or what was it, 100 million IOP workload if we're doing 1,000x in performance.
You know what I think's interesting as well? Maybe from your perspective, Gabriel, is, you know, somebody working for an all-flash array vendor, is that, you know, when NAND flash first came along and EMC were shoehorning it into symmetrics and it was like, really? And they eventually everybody realized, you know what, we need to rewrite the software that runs on these storage arrays because the way that flash works, its inherent properties, the way you can read really fast, but the right overhead performance and where leveling and all of that kind of jazz, right, meant that all of the controller logic and the way that things had to work had to be rewritten. When this comes along, will we have to go through...
You're seeing the same thing with NVMe technologies. Seeing the same thing. I mean, look, the applications can't even... You know, half the applications can't even take advantage of these changes in I/O processing. So, you know, it's great that we can continue to move forward with all these great technologies that are coming out there. But keep in mind, there are a significant amount or series of chain of events that need to happen in the ecosystem as a whole in order to really take advantage of them. So, you know, we do these incremental, it's kind of like, you know, getting a really kick-ass blower for your car, but you're still running on, like, you know, the stock wheels that you bought. And you still have a two-cylinder engine, but you put like a supercharger in, you know, it's almost that type of an effect, right? Where if everything else doesn't line up properly to support the new awesome, you know, high performance portion of it, you're still going to have a bottleneck or you're still going to be bound. So, you know, I think it's cool from a standpoint of, you know, really interesting technology and the potential for a lot of things of it. I just see it from a more pragmatic standpoint of, you know, it's a neat announcement when we actually start to see it and when we see how it starts to be implemented is when I'll be, you know, a lot more interested. I mean, I'm under NDA for a whole bunch of different stuff. There's some super cool stuff coming by 2017 that's going to be like, whoa. But the thing is, I mean, it always works that way, right? We always look out 3 to 5 years. There's the potential for some really awesome things that really shake up everything.
Cool. Sticking with storage, okay. Something that we did talk about on our Slack backend channel this week. This is not news, and it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I think I threw something out on the Slack channel saying I'd seen something from a company that had, I don't know, we've had some...
Macho Man Randy Savage is their spokesperson.
Yeah, so a storage company called Savage.io with a product called Savage Store. And they had some kind of quote. Oh, what was that quote? I think it was something like patent pending, flawless mechanical design of
rails.
The system. It's like...
Unlike other products, we do not mask inadequacies in hardware design by piling software on top of it.
Yeah. So I don't want to rail on them and be like massively harsh. But,
it was obviously, it's a small company out of New York. I don't know who their target customer is. They made some pretty interesting claims that they are outperforms the fastest enterprise storage systems in the world thanks
the
to
densest.
Their patent pending, mechanically flawless design without the inherent physical bottlenecks or storage incompatibilities plaguing traditional storage hardware.
Somebody's done that research.
Wow.
Well, you know,
I just I captured a few of these quotes because they were just so full of crap. And I'm like, you have a 48 drive JBOD box with no software on it. Like, you aren't even storage in my viewpoint. You're a server with a bunch of disks in it.
Well, okay, so Gabriel, you're in the storage industry. I'm a little bit farther from it. I'll take a little bit different approach. You know, these guys are trying to make a splash. First of all, Savage.io is a rocking badass name. I can say that on this podcast. That's an awesome name. All right.
And the logo's pretty badass as well.
It's pretty badass. Put that on a rack and I'd put it in my data center. That's right. But, you know, when I look at these very bold statements, okay, you know, this is not proven in the market.
Fantastical.
Fantastical. Now, I can get where they're coming from trying to make a splash. But, you know, if you think about their message, and if you get 1% of the people to turn their head and take that look, they might be onto something, or for the price point, meet those needs for where they're at. So I'm a big fan of storage for everyone and the fact that we can always have lesser expensive storage. So the more players, the better. The one thing I really struggle with – now, you gravitated, Gabe, on the thunder and lightning statements. Here's a sentence that kind of resonated a little funky with me. Quote, Savage Store provides up to 40% faster compute performance, requires 90% lower management resources, and uses 50% less power and cooling in 75% less space. Hold on. To present an ideal alternative
still
to
going.
Company. This is rougher than second year college calculus.
Did this is basically bullshit from a company that's gotten $580K in funding founded in 2010 and, you know, counts one of their board members is a guy who owns a sheet metal company. Not light the world on fire. I honestly thought it was a joke when I first saw it. And, I don't want to beat anybody down, but, you know, the claims, it just, let's show a little bit of humble and kind of go forward and kind of pick a target audience and do something. I ain't going to knock on anybody who wants to build an array, but it's like, dude, when you come out with a, you know, I want to meet the person who does their marketing and just go, what the F?
Well, let's just meet in the middle, Gabe, and say, I hope you have good backups.
Do you know what, though? On what you said there, Gabriel, I sent a tweet out about it earlier on in the week. And as soon as I'd hit send, I thought, you know what? Is this actually a spoof website? It was that OTT, in my opinion, that I had the cold sweats. And I was like, I might have made myself look a fool on Twitter here. This might be a total spoof. So I had to go and, you know, read several more pages to be like, yeah, you know what? These actually do look like a legit company, and I haven't just been conned. It's not like April 1st or anything.
It could be very well that they have a specific niche industry that they service and, that they're successful in it, right? I mean, I'd never heard of them before. Obviously, founded in 2010. They've been around for a little bit of time. But it just seems interesting to me that there is no storage operating system that they're even talking about. It's essentially a JBOD box. Yeah, so I don't know how you gauge performance and all these other things without a file system or, you know, any real claim, you know, any collateral to back it up. It's basically, you know, it's a lot of claims with extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. But
I need a magic quadrant. I can't take these numbers.
So what I find funny is I just put it on the chat window. They have a chart that compares themselves to some leading storage vendors. That includes Fujitsu, IBM, Pillar, Sun, and NetApp. No EMC, no HP 3PAR. So I actually think NetApp should be insulted that they've been lumped together in this group.
Well, I mean, did they do this in Excel? I mean, this is a pretty Bush League diagram.
No, it's not. That's power. Yeah, that's Excel right there. But also, it's like, where are those dollars per gigabyte coming? Who's paying $33.51 a gig?
Nobody pays street price for storage. And for all the listeners out there, if you do, go buy another storage vendor, and your previous storage vendor, that price will mysteriously go down. Pro tip for you guys.
The price delta there is $33.51 all the way down to 0.52. So 52 cents a gig is what they're charging. And they're saying that NetApp is charging $33.51. I mean, I hope somebody's getting that kind of margin, because I've never seen it. I mean, did they go back to like 2002 to do get NetApp pricing? So, oh yeah, this works. It'll work. You know, let's take the first, you know, let's take, you know what? Let's go take Data General's pricing and we'll use that. And we'll put on top of that.
Brutal.
We're going to take take the cost price index and adjust for inflation.
The fact that it's Pillar and Sun on it, storage on it, tells me this is probably circa 2008.
Wait, yeah. Sun doesn't even make storage anymore. Hold on. I didn't even catch that.
I don't even know if Pillar ever did either.
Sun doesn't exist.
I mean, if you're talking about the Oracle storage tech, that's a totally different product. It doesn't even brand itself at Sun, but Savage is new. Okay. All right, I'm calling a little foul here.
We need to move on because, honestly, my cheekbones are aching or my cheek muscles are aching from smiling and laughing.
We've obviously savaged them enough.
Yeah. So on that, let's switch on to business news as we round things out. I've only got two things on the business news. It seems Amazon Web Services is kind of the golden child inside of Amazon at the moment. So they were showing an operating profit of $391 million for quarter two, which is an annual gain of over 400%, actually. And that $391 million there is actually 36% of the entire Amazon operating profit for the quarter. So Amazon Web Services, effectively the way I read it, accounting for 36% of Amazon's profits for quarter two. Check this out as well. Despite apparently spending over $1.2 billion on AWS infrastructure, and I think that $1.2 billion on the infrastructure is like building data centers and stuff like that. The other point we've got is kind of similar, sticking with cloudy stuff really. Alibaba reportedly plowing $1 billion into its AWS killer, Alion. I'm still not sure how you pronounce that. But apparently they're gunning for growth in Europe and the Middle East and places like that. So in business news, it's all cloudy stuff, but it really looks like Amazon Web Services, now that they're breaking out those numbers, is pretty profitable for Amazon as a whole.
Personally, I think if you're talking about pure public cloud, especially pure public cloud for startups, there's no one that's catching AWS at this point.
I agree totally with you there, Ken, right? But do you think at some point Amazon are going to have to pivot a little bit and support more of a hybrid cloud model? Because it seems, at least to me, right, that Microsoft Azure and a little bit maybe now Google Cloud Platform is saying, we offer a public service, but we'll do on-prem stuff with you, we'll do hybrid. Whereas Amazon Web Services really seems to be very much turning its nose up at anything that's hybrid and gunning for the, in 5 years' time, guys, everything will be public. And that's my interpretation of where Amazon are going with this. And I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that.
Well, Amazon, first of all, does not need to go down the hybrid route on their own, my opinion. They have actually a lot of partners that make things that use AWS in the background, and those partners put things on-prem for customers. So it's a partner-driven hybrid. In my opinion, their approach to hybrid. 180-degree difference, and you missed it on your list, is VMware. They have a single sole vendor stack for that hybrid approach, minus the vCloud Air network, which is basically service providers providing that VMware experience. So to your point, no, AWS doesn't need it. They're freaking making money on it.
They are.
Yeah, and then other point, they're opening up a new center in India, looks like. And by the way, two things. A new zone in India to improve latency for that market. Duh, makes sense. The other thing, Amazon Web Services announced a Frankfurt region in the European Union, which will open in or has opened
That's
in October
open,
14. Yeah. Yeah, but it's their fastest growing international region. Very interesting that the Germans, of all people, are the fastest to look at that cloud thing.
So kind of go full circle a little bit. I think AWS is one kind of the pure public cloud play. I think the one area, if there is an area where they might be vulnerable, it's basically in the enterprise on the hybrid side, right? Mm-hmm. And clearly, I think that's what Google's play is, right? Why are they doing Kubernetes? Why are they having such? It's because they think there's their one shot at potentially, trumping AWS is by partnering with OpenStack and partnering with on-prem container management systems. So I don't know if they'll succeed, but But I think if they were to actually get traction that way, it would be interesting to see how AWS responds.
Yeah, it's just, you know, we've often railed on Google and their inability to compete in that hybrid enterprise space. I mean, we said that they recently added Windows Server to Google Cloud Platform. Kubernetes has gone 1.0. They're getting Kubernetes in with OpenStack, all that kind of stuff. But really, how many enterprises are adopting a cloud and that cloud being Google's cloud platform? I'm sure in that space, Microsoft are running away with it at the moment, right? And is what Google is doing, is that going to be enough there? I'm not certain that it is.
You know, at least at this point with the foundation, right, in Kubernetes, they're actually at this point getting VMware and HP and IBM.
Yeah.
And those folks actually going in and talk about Kubernetes and on their behalf, right? And I think they're hoping that will then spill over into the public cloud.
Cool. Anybody for anything else?
Thanks for having Ken on. I mean, it's just good insight from somebody who's like living in that space that we kind of all have glommed onto lately.
Yeah. What's it like living in that space, actually, Ken? Do you love it?
I most of the time, and then sometimes I have some really crazy Twitter discussions like I had today, where I kind of look at the state of things and I go, this is all going to fail. It's all going to fall apart. No. So look at my Twitter stream from this afternoon. We're having this discussion about how enterprises are starting to think cloud native equals DevOps with containers.
Right.
And that's all it is. I'm like, oh my God, is this where things are headed? No wonder we're going to have plenty of cloud native deployment failures then in the next year or two.
Yeah, I just heard cloud native and I'm like, yeah, cloud. That might work.
Are those guys from Savage.io involved by any chance?
That's right. I'm sure that's going to go into their marketing slide next, how they're better than NetApps at Cloud Containers.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, I think on that note then, we'll wind out for this week. Yes, thanks again, Ken, for being on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yep, thanks for having me on, guys.
And to all the listeners, thanks for tuning in and listening and making it worth our while. And we shall speak again next week.